Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFalla, professor of philosophy at Eastern Sea State University. My guest this morning is David Andre, retired Army infantry colonel who served in Vietnam and also former chairman of the Department of Military Strategy at the National War College. And our topic is the nature and conduct of war. David, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you, Hugh. It's very nice to be with you.
To sort of set the particular things you want to say about the nature and conduct of war into the appropriate context, perhaps it'd be helpful if you just talked a couple of minutes about your experience as an infantry colonel in Vietnam and how that perhaps shaped your views.
I served in Vietnam between 1965 and 1968 in two different American infantry units, the 101st Airborne Division and the 1st Cavalry Division Air Mobile. My first tour, I was a lieutenant. My second tour, I was a captain. During my first tour, I was a rifle company executive officer, second in command, became a company commander when my commander was wounded. I then became a reconnaissance platoon leader in an infantry battalion and then closed out that tour as a support company commander. During my second tour, because I had combat experience, I initially served as the assistant operations officer of the 1st Cavalry Division, where I helped plan their operations. And then, at my request, I was given another rifle company and I commanded that until I was wounded.
In addition to your experience, and feel free as we go along to give details from your experience as you think it helps illuminate this discussion, you also have served as a professor at the National War College, and so you have an academic training and specialty in strategic thinking. Want to talk a little bit at first about the nature of war, and maybe you can give a general outline of what you take the nature of war to be, and then we can perhaps go back and look at each of the points in more detail.
That's an important question, and as an old professor, I'm likely to go on longer than you need or want, so just interrupt me when you feel comfortable. When I think about the abiding or enduring nature of war, several things come to mind. The first is that war is fundamentally about people. Although weapons and other aspects of technology give individual wars part of their distinctive character, war is really about the clash of wills between human beings. This is something that we were told by Karl von Clausewitz, Prussian military philosopher back in the early part of the 19th century, but that remains the case today. And this will continue to be the case as far into the future as I can see, irrespective of the level of technology. War is also about people subjecting other people to different forms of extreme violence. History makes clear that the quickest victories at the smallest price in casualties and other costs result from the application of well-conceived, concentrated, violent, overwhelming, decisive force. So notwithstanding what many critics of the military would have you believe, war is not about seeing how little you can get by with, which is not to say you should apply force in an undisciplined or an excessive way. Another thing about war is that because wars are inherently violent, those who wage it at the point of the spear have got to be able to confront and deal, control fear. Fear as they probably have never known it before. One who has not been to war cannot possibly imagine the kind of fear, including stark terror, that war can engender. At the same time, at least when I go to war, I do not want to have around me anyone who's not at least a little bit nervous. People who say they really aren't afraid give me pause. Which takes me to the other end of the spectrum. The unsung heroes in war are those guys, the vast majority, who keep faith with their buddies and willingly go forth to meet the enemy in spite of their fears, you know, sucking it up and gutting it out for days, weeks, months, even years on end. And they do it in the knowledge that someone they know, perhaps even themselves, likely will be injured or maimed or even killed. Because war centers principally on people who have got to be able to do their jobs in spite of natural fear and in the face of the most appalling kinds of situations, the single most critical ingredient of success in war is highly motivated, well-trained individuals at every level, from the most junior private to the senior general, and well-equipped, well-trained, what we term cohesive fighting units at all echelons. I can tell you from the history of war and from my own personal experience as a commander in war that when all else is lost, cohesion can make the difference between winning and losing, or even between surviving and being utterly destroyed. So anything that can either impede developing cohesion or can act to erode cohesion in an existing fighting unit has to be blocked or eliminated. No ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Could maybe go back and talk about some of those points and then move on and look at a couple of the others as well. The very first point, it seems to me to be a very interesting one, and at odds with the way that many people in the public tend to think about war, the idea that war is a matter of a clash of wills between individuals. Increasingly, and perhaps because the media, individuals think about war as being as concerning primarily technology. People turned on during the Gulf War, people turned on their television sets and watched the latest smart bomb go zipping through and presumably hitting a target somewhere in Baghdad. And that's the image that people have of war, of a giant video game, almost. Yeah, and you're saying that that's not what war is, and moreover, it's not what it is now, it's not what it'll ever be. Could you elaborate on that a bit? Because that's going to strike many listeners as odd.
I'm not saying it's either or. I'm not saying it's either people or equipment. I'm saying it's both. I don't want to have to go and fight with my bare hands. Historically, right up to the present, the character of this or that war has been defined in part by the technology that was employed. The Gulf War is a classic example. Whether you believe it's the end of the old era or the beginning of the new, the technology really mattered. Perhaps not to the extent originally advertised, but it mattered nonetheless. Ask any Iraqi who was on the receiving end. Nonetheless, the technology is employed by human beings. At the highest level, that war was really about the will of Saddam Hussein and his generals, and the will of George Bush and his generals, and everyone below them. And they employed the technology they had at hand. One of the things I do in my professional life is consult on defense matters, including the likely nature of future conflict. As recently as yesterday, in a meeting where we were talking about the trends that are going to define the future, there was something of a disagreement between two of the discussants, and it suddenly dawned on me that the reason they were confused or not agreeing about what the future was going to be like, they hadn't really agreed on the abiding nature of war, what likely was not going to change. And in this case, one guy had made the implicit assumption that people were going to be preeminent. The other one had made the implicit assumption that technology was going to predominate. So it's important to understand basic terms. Okay. And as I say, I am persuaded people have been preeminent, they are preeminent, and it will be that way for as far into the future as I can see.
Okay, so the technology matters because it gives some of the people different tools to use.
Yes.
But it's not as if the people can ever be replaced. it's not as if you can win the war just by using, by having technology.
It's probably fair to say, and even prudent, to replace people with technology where you can. Why send a pilot in harm's way in a $30 million airplane if you can do the same thing with something less expensive with no pilot aboard? At the same time, as a former Army officer, and I know all the Marines in the audience will agree, it's hard to imagine a day when it will not be necessary to put some GI on the ground with a 60-pound rucksack and a rifle to seize and hold terrain. There may be less of it in the future, but it's not going away.
Okay, and so that you think is, so the 2 points. One is, even at the element of the general, who may not see direct action themselves, what matters is the general and the general's will, not necessarily the technology. You got to consider the general's will. And the second point is that there is going to be a continuing role for the combat soldier.
That's my assessment.
Okay. All right. The well, let's move on and talk about, there were a couple more points you wanted to make about the nature of war, if you could.
Yes, and this again ties to the technology aspect in relation to people. Because war is mainly about people operating individually and in units, the conduct and the outcome of war often turns on the interplay of the element of chance and what Carl von Clausewitz called the friction and the fog of war, which he also said is the essence of the difference between real war and war on paper. We could have a long exegesis, which I'll reduce simply by saying that the concept of fog in war involves things like a lack of knowledge or simply not understanding what's going on even in the presence of adequate knowledge. Friction, on the other hand, while related to fog, results from being scared, from being tired, which can lead to confusion, to hesitancy, and to honest human errors. And even in the best of circumstances, you always have to realize that Murphy's Law is operative. Things can go wrong. Friction and fog operating together result in things being both harder to do and taking longer than you thought during the planning that it would take. Clausewitz said that in war, even the simplest things are hard to do. There is no professional soldier who spent a night in the field who does not agree with that. But yet, when you talk to people about the future of war and the wonders of modern technology, and some of it truly is wondrous, there are people who believe that friction and fog will be all but eliminated in the future. I'm willing to say that it's going to be reduced somewhat. But as long as people are operating these systems, no matter what the level of technology, friction and fog will be present, and that is going to determine outcomes probably as often as our technology versus someone else's. One final point I'd like to make, Hugh, that people need to remember, and this is particularly pertinent, I think, for those in the national security realm. Wars never end. At least not for those who have to fight them. There is, in my view at least, absolutely nothing else in life that compares with the kind of assault that mortal combat at any level makes on all of your senses, on every fiber of your physical, your emotional, and your spiritual being. Few soldiers, in my experience, are ever the same after having lived through it. The experience can be profoundly mind-altering and even life-changing, which is to say that almost everyone who's involved in war at the point of the spear becomes a casualty of some kind. There's a story that I like to tell that was told to me by Joe Galloway, who writes for US News, who was a reporter in Vietnam and helped write a wonderful book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, along with General Hal Moore, about that war. Joe was in the Persian Gulf at the start of the war and was talking to an Army brigadier who'd been a lieutenant in Vietnam, and he asked this guy, how important was Vietnam to you? And the brigadier looked startled for a moment and then said to Joe, he said, you know, Vietnam has meant everything to me. It is the lens through which I view life and judge people. That is a profound statement, but it's an eloquent statement that I think almost anyone I know would sign up for.
Could you elaborate on why that's so, how it's so?
Because war is such a defining experience for anyone who participates in it at the point of the spear. It is such a human phenomenon, but at the same time is so unnatural to the average person. It takes some getting used to. I remember a few years ago, I came across a book that was published in 1967 called The Forgotten Soldier. It's a wonderful book. The author ostensibly was a man by the name of Guy Sager. Now, he may be an individual or a composite, but in any event, he was portrayed as a World War II German infantryman from Alsace who fought against the Russians for 4 years on the Eastern Front, if you can imagine such a thing. You open the cover of the book, and on the first page, Sager wrote the following, which I think talks right to your question. He said, a day came when I should have died. And after that, nothing seemed important. So I have stayed as I am, without regret, separated from the normal human condition. When I read that, it stunned me, because I suddenly realized after 30 years from the time I left Vietnam, he was really describing my situation in some sense, as well as that for a lot of other combat vets. One other short vignette. One time in Vietnam, the unit I was commanding, along with others, went to the relief of a special forces camp that had been under siege for quite some time up in the highlands near Laos. We fought our way into the compound, and when we got in there, there was stenciled on the side of one of the buildings in that special force